This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
We know the rates of mental ill health are just far too high. I grew up feeling like having a genuine sense of understanding that life shouldn't be taken for granted and that there were things that were worth working for and fighting for and believing in. You know, if you can bring together passion and purpose and professional expertise together, you can have an impact.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. On this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Rowland, the Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation. The Mental Health Foundation began over 70 years ago and is the only UK charity solely focused on preventing poor mental health and building and protecting good mental health. There are a number of things that Mark has done throughout his career, working in international development, and he was awarded the President's Medal by the Royal College of Psychiatry in June 2022. I'm really looking forward to talking to him about the world of mental health and how people can improve their own. Mark, welcome to the podcast. As listeners will know from my introduction, you're an expert in mental health and well-being, and we'll talk about your role as CEO of the Mental Health Foundation. But before that, I just want to talk a little about you and what motivates you and your background. Was there anything in your early years, in your school years, that made you think that you were going to go into the charitable world and then end up in the world of mental health?
Yeah, great question. Great to be with you, Mark. Thank you very much for the invite. I think the signs were there quite young for me. I was raised in Central Africa in a small country called Rwanda, right on the equator, where you could fry an egg on the corrugated iron roofs of our house. Beautiful land to live in, beautiful people. We went to the local school. My father was a doctor. My mother was a teacher. So they, you know, that was very formative for me up until myself and my brothers were 6 years old, really immersed in African culture.
And did you live in Kigali?
No, we were in a little town to the east called Gahini. So it was really remote. Father working in the as the only doctor in the local hospital, right at the start of the big epidemic around HIV, so and AIDS, which was just emerging at the time. You know, saw in my father and my mother a purpose-driven life, one which was focused on service. It was very much informed by their faith, and one that was focused on community and making a contribution and a willingness to tear up the script and do something a bit different, even though I didn't realise. I thought that was just the norm. I just thought everyone just sort of migrated to Africa at some point in their working life. So that was probably very formative for me in terms of thinking, yeah, I want to make a difference with this one life I have.
And so what happened after your time in Africa?
Well, we came back to England, and I was obviously, you know, really young, finding my own way. But I think I'd set on maybe taking the family business on to a sort of modern footing. My parents were missionaries, but I was really convinced going through university and coming out of university. I was very involved in the sort of student politics movement. At the time, there was a big campaign to drop the debt from developing world countries. I remember being part of dressing up in a in sort of Hessian sacks and doing the protests. So my sense of, I guess, a sense of vocation was to make a contribution in international development to address issues around global poverty. And looking back, I was super ambitious and very committed to making a contribution in that sphere, but definitely influenced by the fact that I'd seen the reality of poverty and its impact on people growing up. And I'd also seen the absolutely devastating impact of war and conflict on particularly women and girls in Rwanda. We left just before the genocide, which was in 1994, where 800,000 people were killed in in about 100 days. So it was, I grew up feeling like having a genuine sense of understanding that life shouldn't be taken for granted, and that there were things that were worth working for and fighting for, and believing in, which is very idealistic, but certainly gave me a lot of drive.
So when you left university, what did you do, given that you had that background and clearly you had that passion to do something that made a difference?
Yeah, I my first job out of university was working in human rights. So working for a small organization, working out of Guildford, working particularly on children's rights and religious liberty issues. But my actual first job was to campaign for a British guy who was in prison in Myanmar, Burma. And he his name was James Maudsley, and he had gone as a 28-year-old, and had gone and made a peaceful protest, and said, reopen the universities, reduce the price of basic commodities like rice, and release political prisoners. And he had made this peaceful protest knowing he would get arrested, but wanted to raise the profile of human rights abuses in Myanmar. And he was arrested and thrown into solitary confinement. And my first job was to run the campaign to work with the family, work with the Foreign Office, and to get him released. So it was kind of like my dream job. It was like I came out of university thinking, how can I make a difference? And then had the opportunity to make a difference on a very specific case, with also being able to paint on a slightly broader canvas, because we were trying to raise a much broader issues, particularly about many of the minority ethnic communities that were getting systematically displaced from their home by the Burma army in Burma. So that was my first job, and it was probably, one of the most exciting jobs I'd ever taken on.
And what was the outcome, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, we worked hard. We worked with the UN's panel for arbitrary detention. We got a verdict from them saying he was being arbitrarily detained. We did things like on his birthday, February the 28th, we got his mum and his dad with a birthday cake, and we had built a bamboo prison outside the Burmese embassy in London, and we wrapped the cage in birthday paper, took that off, and I'm not kidding you, we didn't just get one or two press, we got a bank of London's press corps focused on this British guy who was in prison in Burma. And we just caused so much of a nuisance to the embassy and to the consulate staff that in the end he was released about 14 months after solitary confinement. He'd experienced a lot, but he came out and then wrote a book about it called The Heart Must Break. And it was, an incredible experience, a whirlwind. There was a documentary made, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just a, we won, and we'd managed to get him out, but also succeed in also raising the profile of the wider issues as well.
So obviously that then gave you a taste to do even more. You're straight out of university, you've done this, you've made an impact. So tell us about your journey then, because it was in 2018 that you went to be the CEO of the Mental Health Foundation, but I know you did lots of things before that. So just talk us through what came after that and your progression to doing what you're doing today.
So yeah, I kind of worked myself out of a job ha with having James Maudsley released, and I focused on kind of marketing and communications and fundraising in international development. I went and spent a year actually working on the Thai-Burma border, where a lot of the displaced Karen, Karenni, Shan minority groups had been that I was raising awareness of previously. And I went and we went there and lived on the Thai-Burma border, had some incredible experiences working with relief teams, humanitarian teams, bringing medical assistance and cash and aid. And, you know, as a young person, I think I was 29, that was also fantastic because we in order to get into Myanmar or Burma at the time, you had to trek in. You had to go in illegally. So you had to sleep in the jungle. You were working with relief teams, carrying food, money, medical assistance to displaced communities. So went work there, and that was so humbling, incredibly energizing, incredibly meaningful. I remember once we ended up at this village called Loy Te Lang, and it was a sort of short mountain strip in Shan State in Myanmar. And we really the principle of the relief teams that we were working with was we won't run if the people won't run. And so we'd managed to get to them, bring assistance, and they put on a huge celebration for us. It was just 2 or 3 days of being with the community, them feeling connected, supported, but also joining in with some very incredible sort of cultural events. I remember, you know, they set up a competition where you'd have to get on a high wooden bar, and it was like a pillowcase fight. And you'd kind of look, try to not be knocked off. And I went up against the Shan champion. And you've got to be careful, a couple of swings and you can knock yourself off. So I went for a swing, was a bit unsteady and got absolutely swiped off. But you know, they were very formative experiences. And I think then I kind of, but I had to make a decision whether I was going to stay in Asia or come back to the UK and work in international development from there, which is what I ultimately chose to do.
And tell me, what did you learn from that time? You said you learned a lot. What did you learn?
This is going to sound trite, but the incredible resilience, there's so much that we can learn from other cultures, and particularly those who were being systematically persecuted. The support that they offered each other and the solidarity that they stood to, the collective, the investment in the collective, meant that there was a psychological protection that they experienced that many of us don't experience. We aren't really designed to stand on our own facing life's slings and arrows. We're designed to stand with other people, protected by, and to give that protection. And when you are both offering it and offered it, the power for you is greater than the sum of the parts. And I think I saw just a life that was in that community in Loy Te Lang, not just a resilience, but a joy and a vitality, even in amongst incredible pressure, that was incredibly inspiring.
And when you came back to the UK, did that feel very different then, Mark?
Yeah, it did. You know, it was funny because I experienced that both coming back from Thailand, but also coming back from Africa. I remember when I was growing up in Africa in the local schools, we were treated as honored guests. And I remember coming back to my primary school in Seaford, and I remember a boy joining who had come from Africa and was a migrant to the UK. And the reaction of the class was the opposite of what I'd experienced in Africa. It was fold your arms, look at that kid, and say, "Well, you've got to work your way into this in-group. We'll start from a position of suspicion." Whereas my experience was, we'll start from a position where we welcome you and we honor the outsider. And that was very humbling to see. And I experienced the same when I came back to the UK. You know, I was still young, but I think I just came back with a passion for that if you can. You know, if you can bring together passion and purpose and professional expertise together, you can have an impact. So I even though I wasn't going to be in Asia, I brought our family back here. I was really determined to bring those three things: passion, professionalism and purpose into my future life. I was really fortunate to be able to have the opportunity to do that. I know that's not the case for everyone.
And then tell us why you left International Development to join the Mental Health Foundation as CEO, because that's 2018, so good few years ago now, so you've firmly got your feet under the desk.
Yeah, I'd done an MBA. I felt I wanted to not have a glass ceiling, even though I was working in the voluntary sector. I wanted to understand how the elements of running organizational lives and also be a bit more exposed to sort of the commercial realities and be able to read a balance sheet and a profit and loss sheet and be able to hold my own with proper business people, not just with the voluntary sector. So I did that, and then just as I was completing that, my whole sort of world was shaken really, because my older brother Daniel, who was a role model for me, super fiercely intelligent, man of integrity, was so lived with very acute depression. And he, I hope it's okay to say, but he went through a very acute depressive episode, and he went into hospital, and he was in hospital for several weeks. He got a little bit better. And we thought that was the start of his recovery. But it wasn't. He got well enough to plan and execute his own suicide. And that was just devastating. Died in hospital. And I think the ramifications for us as a family were just huge. And it was like a mirror shattering on the floor into a million pieces. Where do you even start to make sense of what's just happened? And I think that was my sort of journey towards the mental health world.
So what did you do next? Because as you say, that must have been devastating for you and the family. So how did you work your way from doing what you were doing to where you are now?
Well, I didn't have a plan, and I think, but I just remember feeling that we had to turn and look at and not ignore what had happened. You couldn't ignore it. But there is, subsequently found out, Mark, that when, especially when you've had a traumatic bereavement, there's almost like a fork in the road. There's definitely a kind of post-traumatic, well, more that people can get stuck in that grief. That astonishing loss can contain them and imprison them for years, and it's difficult to move forward. But there is a group of people who also do move forward and are able to integrate that experience. And the difference between the two groups from the research is if you can find purpose and meaning from the loss that you've experienced. And I didn't do that intentionally, but I was naturally interested in thinking, I've been working on the issue around poverty eradication, the impact of not having enough physical resources to be able to provide for your own self and your family and your basic needs. But there is also a reality around an inner poverty in our emotional lives that is equally devastating. And I just reached the point in international development where I felt more and more uncomfortable about a white guy. I wasn't sure that big Western organizations, white-led organizations, had the answers for Africa's issues around poverty. So there was a sort of also a sort of philosophical journey that I was going on there. And I just naturally very interested in my own grief journey. And as with a lot of people who go through a loss to suicide, you're just immediately confronted with what could have been different? How could that have been prevented? And I think all of those sorts of campaigning, social justice motivations sort of flowed into a question around mental health. And I didn't go seeking it. I just got a previous donor who had supported the work while I was working at Christian Aid, sent me an email, and he said, "Would you want to apply for this role?" It wasn't a chief executive role, it was a director role at the time. I said yes and looked at it, and it went from there.
And so I know that the Mental Health Foundation is the only charity in the UK that solely focuses on issues around mental health. So it would be really good just to hear you talk about the work you do, how you help individuals, how you help organisations.
The Mental Health Foundation has been around for about 75 years, so a lot longer than me. It's got a rich heritage and pedigree, and really started to try to address the anomaly around the amount of research that goes into mental health versus physical health. And we've really developed a focus on prevention in mental health, taking an understanding of how you build a mentally healthy society and the different intervention points across the life course that can and should be done to reduce the risk of mental ill health, promote recovery. We have research teams that are working across the UK on different elements around stigma reduction, the impact of racism on mental health, the economic impact, what workplaces can do. We've got a set of evaluation teams that are working to evaluate different interventions in communities. And we also have a programs team that works in communities, working with at-risk populations to test and try out new ideas to help disrupt the pathway, which we know is well established for particular groups, and show that you can effectively prevent poor mental health with the right resources at the right time. So we have research, community programs. We also have a policy and advocacy team which try and take those findings and advocate to UK governments. And we have a strong line in public information. So that's equipping individuals with the resources and try to bust some of the myths and give a credible, reliable, evidence-based advice and support about how to protect your mental health and how to have good and what the barriers are to good mental health and how to address them. So it's a fascinating honour to and a really varied job in covering lots of different issues. You describe me as an expert, but I really describe myself as someone who is looking to ask good questions, and certainly not someone with all the answers, but we're an organisation that wants to be asking better questions and finding better solutions.
And for those listening to this podcast, what are the biggest myths to bust?
I think one of the myths is that mental illness or mental ill health falls like a Damocles sword out of nowhere. It just hit you one day. It's because you're maybe there's something wrong with your brain. There's an insufficient, let's say, serotonin. There's a serotonin deficiency, and that was, a really common explanation for the rates of, say, depression and anxiety. But it hasn't really been borne out by the evidence since, in terms of there being an a priori, some pe a priori cause that is linked to the kind of secretion of serotonin in the brain. There isn't a sort of a gene that. A single gene that gives you a higher risk of certain depressive illnesses. So one of the things I would say is a myth is that your quality of your mental health is defined at your birth, that it's in your genes. There is a temperament, there is a biological underpinning to mental ill health, but it's like the saying is like, genes load the gun, but your experiences and what happens to you fires it. And that's why, so it's malleable. And that's why when you experience a period of mental ill health, it's really important to understand why has this happened? Where has it come from? What are the tributaries that has arrived me at this place? And that is a really good place for a conversation about then what you can do and what healing and recovery might look like.
Your organization is decades and decades old. Over the course of that time, do you think that mental health issues have become more severe? Do you think we're more aware of them? Is it the same that it's always been? How would you describe the history as you know it from your foundation?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're just doing a piece of work across the UK, looking at it's going to be an annual longitudinal study looking at the trends and people's experiences. But we are and we're using data sets working with academic partners that can also go backwards as well as forwards. So we're building up a pretty clear picture, and the reported distress, the levels of diagnosable mental ill health that people are saying, yes, that's my experience, is rising. It has been rising, and it has been rising around the world as well. So you really, while we're seeing massive gains in relation to reduction in preventable deaths for children under five, chronic ill health, and mental health is one of those, is it has been significantly rising. There are probably three or four big reasons for that. The first is higher rates of social inequality within communities and within countries, which we know is difficult for human beings to be able to process if someone's doing disproportionately well for limited extra talent, and your position in life relative to that is poorer and you're struggling, that makes a big difference. We've had several economic, health, and conflict kind of instability that has, I think, made a massive difference over the last 5 years to people's sense of security, their sense that they're safe, their sense that they can. So that both those things increase uncertainty, which is a reliable driver of mental ill health. And then you've had the rise of new technology, which has had some positive impacts, but also some destructive impacts. And then thirdly, and then fourth, so you've had technology, inequality, some big shocks to us globally. And then, but finally, as you say, we've also had greater openness. So we are uncovering more hidden distress than we have before. So it is difficult to take a definitive comparison to the past, because so much mental ill health was either ignored, pushed down, or expressed in different ways. So it's difficult to get a definitive sense of a comparison to the past. We just know, we just try and say we know the rates of mental ill health are just far too high as they currently are. That we can be absolutely clear on. When you've got, one in four people experiencing diagnosable levels of mental ill health, and it rises to one in two over the lifetime, of, and that comes at huge human and economic and social costs.
Mark, what advice would you give to people listening to this about maintaining good mental health? If there's something that people can go away and do that's going to help them, what would it be?
Ah, it's a great question. I think the first starting point is one around openness and curiosity. It's like, what is actually your experience, and what is happening there, and what are the consequences of that? And being able to articulate that to yourself, a friend, in a diary is really the starting point. It's amazing, Mark, how the levels of emotional literacy, just being able to describe what you feel, what is your experience of walking through this life, is still quite low. And especially for men, we still don't have the skills to be actually able to say, to be able to name what we've actually experienced. And that basic skill is meaning that we go years avoiding things, reacting in ways that are destructive, using alcohol, using other coping mechanisms, instead of facing and turning what is causing that pain and having it resolved. And I think if you can develop good, healthy habits of dealing with difficult emotions, you can prevent those turning into longer term mental health problems. So in terms of what individuals can do, there's a lot of things that we can do differently as a society, but I would say that investing time in that emotional literacy and understanding what's going on for you and why, is probably the biggest difference that can lead you to better mental health and a better quality of your sort of day-to-day experience.
And how can people learn to do that?
Well, I mean, we've got a lot of resources on our website, on our social media channels, and I think it really starts with a desire to want to say, I'm gonna, its first step is like courage. It's like I'm actually going to spend some time asking the right questions. I think it feels scary, but it's a very small step. And we had a meeting at work recently, and we start our meetings by asking people to just check in. And one colleague checked in and gave a score out of 10, which was quite low, and followed up with them afterwards and asked what was happening. And they just described something that was, they described that their decision that something had been causing them pain and distress for many years, and they were going to tackle it. They were going to turn and face it. They were going to address it. And that is the first decision point, is naming what is happening, and then bringing it into the light and talking to someone about it. Depending on who that person is and the degree of the problem, it may look differently for different people, but the first thing is a willingness to say, what's holding me back? And a decision to say, I'm going to look at that and explore it.
To finish, Mark, I'm really keen to know where you see the future of the foundation. It's been going for a very long time, but just talk to me about how you see the next 5 years, both for you and also for the Mental Health Foundation.
That's a great question. I see us, I think we're an organization with tremendous potential, one that I think is going to be increasingly focused on creating movements for change around the way in which society needs to be different. So we do two things in summary. One is like, what's the evidence and research needed to point to the change that's necessary in society? And what's an effective way to equip people with the tools that they need to manage their own mental health successfully and be an authority? So we want to do those two things better through the lens of probably four or five big societal issues that we think can be different. We think that, whether or not that's looking at online safety and our navigating our online world, whether it's about addressing bullying, whether it's about addressing loneliness. So I think the future for us is going to be in really providing some thought leadership and some focus around big societal issues that need to change, and then both equipping people with the tools that they can learn from about how to address those problems, but also taking a policy and societal approach as well, and hopefully them seeing meeting in the middle for significant change. And that's what we're after. So a bit more of a campaigning and movement building emphasis of our work, turning research into real change.
And what about you personally?
Reflecting on this podcast, I want to keep being creative. I want to keep having a working with great people where there's real trust and vulnerability. I think that's such an important component of working life. I really enjoy working at the foundation and bringing a sense of play and fun into the workplace, and then ultimately a sense of purpose. So I'm not looking more than maybe a couple years down the track, but I'd love to keep leading in the voluntary sector, and I also think that there's a role to help other leaders to manage their mental health in a way that enables them to lead in a sustainable, authentic, and effective way, and I think that's also something I'm having to learn every day about how to do that, and I'd like to be able to support others in that endeavour.
Well, thank you for doing that, Mark. Thank you for sharing your story and the work of the Mental Health Foundation. We're very pleased and proud to be partnering with you at Workle. We hope that we can further amplify your great work, and we wish you every success. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a real privilege to speak to you.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workle.co. Work happier.